Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen. Co-host Gene DiNardo can't make it today. Jake Town might make it. Don't know if he's going to make it or not. And Bill G's not in town, so looks like yours truly may end up doing this show solo. But we'll just see if we just go through the headlines like we normally do. It is Thursday, August 2nd, 2012, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. We'll be talking about the fiscal cliff that the U.S. faces. Congress appears to be putting off any decision on it until the end of the year, but if Congress isn't able to do anything, that amounts to a $7 trillion tax increase. That's pretty serious stuff. We'll take a look at what's happening with Julian Assange, who's still cooped up in the Ecuadorian embassy in the United Kingdom. We'll take a look at news today of a resignation by a top-level UN diplomat regarding the situation in Syria. Congressman Ron Paul of Texas announces on his congressional website that audit the Fed has moved forward, and we'll have details on that. Stocks today ended lower on disappointment that the various central banks around the world took no actions whatsoever to stimulate the economy. We'll look at that. Greece, according to the Latvian finance minister, should be leaving the Eurozone as soon as possible. It can't leave soon enough as far as he's concerned. We'll talk about that. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Francois Hollande, they have pledged they're going to do everything they can to protect the euro. And in fact, today, European Central Bank President Mario Draghi once again waded in saying that the European Central Bank is also going to take some actions. He's been signaling that for quite some time, but no actions have been taken so far. But the big story this week that we're going to be focusing on, first off, is the continuing saga known as the LIBOR manipulation scandal. And we have two stories we're going to talk about today. First of all, news coming out of New York that the ValueWalk.com is calling the bank wars is now starting up. And let me just read you a little bit from ValueWalk.com's article. There are actually a number of articles on the web that you can read about this. But it appears that while Barclays may have paid $450 million in lawsuit charges and seen two of its top executives depart owing to the LIBOR manipulation situation, it turns out that latest reports show that LIBOR is something that is beginning to take center stage. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Berkshire Bank, that's a New York-based lender with a total of 11 branches across New York and New Jersey, with an asset value of approximately $811 million, is seeking a lawsuit against the LIBOR manipulators, claiming the low LIBOR rate contributed to low interest income from loans tied to the global benchmark rate. Elsewhere, Pensions and Investments Online reported that BlackRock Incorporated, Fidelity Investments, and Vanguard Group are also considering taking legal action against the LIBOR manipulators, citing that their clients have been hurt by the action of the reportedly dozen banks under investigation. And it looks like Jake Town was able to join us today. Jake, welcome to the program. As you may have heard as you were connecting in, LIBOR continues to be in the news. And, in fact, we're going to talk in a minute about something really big that came out within the last couple of days here. But LIBOR is not going away anytime soon, is it?
No. It's kind of a can of worms for the whole banking industry. And as it continues, you know, it's we remarked that mainstream media was kind of mum when it was first coming out, but it's such a big story in that they were blatantly at the end of the day, you know, I almost put it to like the movie Office Space. In the movie Office Space, some guys that work for a company and they embezzle by stealing fractions of a penny from every accounting change, and you know, it's a comedy. But this is certainly not a comedy. But they're doing, by manipulating interest rates, in effect, they were doing the exact same thing. Stealing fractions of pennies or more than that, sometimes far more than that, depending on the size of the loan from people all over the world.
Absolutely true, and it's something that's been going on a lot longer than was previously acknowledged, although we've talked about it in a number of different ways here on this program, and it's been going on for decades. But today, allegations came out. Actually, I believe this came out last week, excuse me, but allegations came up that this kind of activity has been going on since at least 1991, and that's according to a Financial Times op-ed by former Morgan Stanley trader Douglas Keenan. He claims that LIBOR has been jerked around, in his words, for fun and profit as long ago as 1991. Now, reading from a Huffington Post article on the subject, this one written by, Mark Gonglas wrote this one. He makes an interesting comment here. He says, let that sink in for just a minute. LIBOR was being manipulated 17 years before the financial crisis and Geithner's Babe in the Woods discovery of it, according to Keenan. Geithner wasn't in charge of the New York Fed at the time, but if this was widespread knowledge years before his arrival, it makes you wonder how he could not have heard about it for so long. Well, yes, that's true. It does make you wonder how he could not have heard about it, but it also makes you wonder how nobody else heard about it either. I mean, something that's been going on that long and that is that well known by the top players in the industry, considering also the fact that many of those top players ended up as, U.S. Treasury secretaries?
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
I don't think any of us really believe that nobody knew this was going on, that this was just a few rogue traders. This has been business as usual for quite some time.
Absolutely. And what came out of Reuters over the past week was there was more banks involved in it, the UK Royal Bank of Scotland and Switzerland's UBS. And UBS has a stateside, a U.S. Presence as well. So the whole thing is just going to keep unfolding. And like we talked about, you know, when they compute the LIBOR, they toss out the high and the low. So obviously, if they're being successful in bumping the rates one way or the other, it was probably a collusion of banks.
Oh, yeah, it has to be collusion. I mean, you can't have a manipulation on this scale without large-scale collusion, which means that everybody's in on it. It means that all the major financial powers of the world are in on it. You can't have just like only, say, the UK and Switzerland doing it. It just doesn't work because of the nature of the way the thing is set up. It has to be everybody involved. And the only way it can be everybody involved is if the central banks know about it, if the finance ministers and the Secretary of the Treasury know about it, if the leaders of the countries know about it, they all have to know about it. Because the moment that you have even one significant player who doesn't know about it, who finds out, all of a sudden he or she feels like they've been left out of, the grab bag. And they're not going to let that happen. So, of course, everybody knows about this.
Right.
Whether or not we're getting any action on the front of, oh, yeah, we admit that we knew about this, that's another question. But clearly everybody had to know.
Now, it reminds me of the comedian George Carlin's quote, that it's a big club and you ain't in it. That's pretty much how it is.
That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Sad but true. Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, part of the reason that the LIBOR manipulation scandal is so important, and a reason that doesn't get hardly any attention in the press, is that it has a very significant purpose beyond the fact that it lines the pockets of the players who are at the center of it. It also helps to support worldwide monetary policy by the various central banks that want to do everything they can to pretend that inflation isn't going on and that currencies aren't being devalued, when in fact, of course, the opposite is exactly what's been happening, because they are enamored of the Keynesian philosophy that if you keep expanding the money supply through what they call stimuluses, that you will have a robust and healthy economy. And we have learned the hard way, well, we're in the process of learning the hard way, that that's not true. But nevertheless, that is the overall policy that everybody wants to pursue. It's one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve has such low interest rates in mind for their targets. It's one of the reasons why the European Central Bank also has low interest rates in mind for their target. That's part of how they stimulate the economy, how they expand the money supply without actually admitting that they're expanding the money supply. And we're seeing more of that today. In fact, the markets have been looking for it. The markets have been noticing, to no one's surprise, that the economies of the world are suffering, that they are slipping further and further toward recession. Actually, factor out inflation, and they are all in recession. But nobody admits to that either. And they've all been looking to the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank to step in. Well, they were disappointed this week because neither of them did. The Fed issued a statement saying they weren't going to do anything except stay the course. And Mario Draghi of the European Central Bank kept saying he was going to do something, but he didn't do anything either. Well, turns out that today he came out once again and said, yep, we're going to do something. It's going to happen. We will do whatever we have to do to protect the euro. Once again, he didn't really say what they were going to do. But, Jake, Fiverr will get you, too, that it's going to be more money printing.
Yeah, it doesn't take too much brain power to figure that out.
You get the feeling we talk about the same story over and over on this program?
Sometimes, yes.
It's really rather sad when you think about it, but hey, that's really what's going on. That's why we keep talking about this stuff, because this is not just like a little story. This is not something that's, you know, one of those sidebar stories that don't really count for anything. Even though the major media doesn't cover this, folks, this is what's driving everything. This is what's behind the entire ball wax. So that's why we keep focusing on it. Meanwhile, we also had word this week from German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande. They pledged this past Friday to do all in their power to protect the euro after discussing the latest events in the debt crisis by telephone. A couple of interesting quotes. I'm not sure how interesting, but hey, you got to report this stuff because they're the powers that be. One quote, Germany and France are deeply committed to the integrity of the eurozone. They are determined to do everything to protect the eurozone, they said in a joint statement, which echoed comments one day earlier by the European Central Bank chief. Germany's center-right leader and the socialist president of France said all Eurozone member states and European institutions must meet their commitments, quote, within the realm of their own competencies, unquote. I like that last phrase. You know, the realm of their own competencies. Competencies is one of those words that has sort of a double-edged meaning here, because on the one hand, from a true economics perspective, from the perspective of healthy, rational, strong economics, all of these leaders are completely incompetent. I mean, they're all following the crazy Mr. Keynes, and the crazy Mr. Keynes is who they've been following for decades, and that crazy Mr. Keynes is about to lead us off a cliff. But on the other hand, these are very, very intelligent people with high-powered degrees from very high-powered universities and long lists of credentials and so forth. So it's a weird thing. I mean, you have the leaders of the countries who are basically just politicians doing whatever they can to hold on to and increase their political power. You have the bankers and the central bankers who are doing everything they can to hold on to their monetary power. And we have this statement about the realm of their competencies. So competencies, what does that mean in this context? Is this the competency to see how much value we can steal from the entire population and tell the entire world that we're making them more prosperous? Or is this the competency of actually facing up to the reality of the situation, saying, hey, we got to do something different here because what we're doing isn't working? I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just being a little bit optimistic here, but I always try to hope that maybe somebody will actually see the light, Jake. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's going to happen in France, and that's going to be interesting to see how, you know, the French election that elected Hollande from the Socialist Party to the head of the French government, you know, since being in power. He's moved he moved down the pension age that French employees can retire at down a couple years, and I think he increased the minimum wage because, of course, that must be what to do if people don't have work.
So, that's right, of course.
You know, those types of measures, and you know, just the fact that one of the reasons why France was behind forming the euro in the first place was this tendency to be able to take really from the other countries, in this case, namely Germany, and have the money printing power of the loss of purchasing power that they saw in the French franc to kind of tie it into the German Deutschmark through the euro and kind of have it all blend together. It'll be interesting to see how the people of both France and Germany start viewing each other, because you know, the German people, the workers, are being taken advantage of for sure.
Yeah, that's true, and that's something I've been wondering about for quite some time, because socialists, liberals, left in general have long been the ones who supposedly stood for and stood on the side of the workers, the repressed, the lower classes, and so on and so forth, and yet they're also the ones who stand four squares with John Maynard Keynes, which is diametrically the opposite of the interests of the same groups they stand, they claim to be standing with. So you're right, that's going to be very interesting to watch. In fact, just this past week, I live in Virginia, and as you know, Virginia is one of the swing states for the coming election here in this country, and we're getting a lot of stuff on the airwaves and a lot of telephone calls, polling calls, and calls trying to convince us to vote one way or the other, that kind of thing. We're only in August, and I'm already sick of it. But I got a phone call from somebody in the Obama camp just yesterday, I think it was. And this person was asking me who I was going to vote for, and I said, well, I can tell you with an extremely high level of confidence, I'm not going to vote for either the Democrat or the Republican. And that's when I found out that she was calling on behalf of Obama and asked me why. And I said, well, they really aren't paying attention to the most important issue. And she said, well, what's the most important issue? I said, well, it's monetary policy and the monetary and banking system. And she said, oh, you mean the budget? And I said, no, not the budget. The monetary system, the monetary and banking system, the system that basically uses the fact that it's able to elastically expand the money supply in order to steal money from everybody. That's the system I'm talking about. And she said, oh, you're talking about inflation. I said, well, yeah, inflation is certainly a part of it, but really what I'm talking about is their ability to decrease the purchasing power of monetary units, including the dollar, and that they do this primarily to support the monetary and banking system, to support the government, which lives heavily on this system. Well, that's about as far as I got. She did say that she was going to bring the issue up to her superiors, and then she started trying to argue with me about how Obama was such a good president. And she was making comments about the stimuluses that the Obama administration has put in and so forth. And I said, no, the stimuluses are doing just the opposite. Well, she didn't want to hear that. And that's the key point that I wanted to raise here. She didn't want to hear that. She didn't want to hear the idea that the stimuluses, which are supposed to help all the people that the Democrats say they want to help, are actually harming them. And that's really a very... frightening, discouraging, I'm not sure what the right adjective is, but it's a startling, shall we say, a very startling observation to make, that the people who claim to be supporting and standing for the dispossessed, the poor, the people who are most at risk of monetary system manipulation, those are the very people who are not willing to hear about and discuss the root of the issue. I mean, that just really caught my attention.
Well, you know, those who, you have to ask yourself who benefits, and it's certainly not us.
No, it's not us. And I can honestly say that it was the caller who benefited either. I mean, she's basically just the staffer, working for a campaign, making phone calls, and rather a thankless job, to be sure. I have to admit, I hung up on her because I got tired of her refusing to listen to what I had to say. But... ultimately, there's not a whole lot that she gains from it, other than maybe she hopes to get, some sort of a political job once Obama gets elected. But beyond that, I mean, it's not like she's going to be one of the major players in this thing. It's not like she's going to have a major role in deciding what's going to happen with monetary policy. So she's basically a victim like all the rest of us. And yet, she didn't want to listen. She did not want to hear. All she was interested in doing was talking about how wonderful President Obama has been. That's really sad.
Right, and she did mention the budget, and if you go to treasurydirect.gov and take a look at the debt outstanding, you'll see that it hasn't taken very long. I mean, if you go back to you only have to go back to November of 2011 when we crossed $15 trillion, and now what are we at, about 8 months later, we were right about to cross $16 trillion. And at that rate, we're getting close to the point where that will start to increase exponentially. And the other thing that's also alarming is when you break it down by the interest expense per month, we just had June, which is one of the four larger of the months, but I believe they set a record in interest paid with 104, hold on, there's a lot of zeros, $104 billion in interest expense paid to owners of the treasuries in June. That's just June.
And that was 0.25% interest?
Well, a lot of the debt, the new debt that's being issued, of course, is about that level. But, I have to recall that, the 10-year, the 30-year notes that have gone out before are accumulating interest at different amounts. But, yeah.
But nonetheless.
Yeah, and, you know, for the government, it's actually kind of, you know, a deal to be able to, you know, roll over your debt at, I think, the 10-year note somewhere around the 1.5% region. It's, you know, kind of a no-brainer, except for the fact that, you know, you're not collecting enough revenue to ever pay back the loan, so you're always going to have to keep issuing more interest rates, and it's just a matter of time, I think. And, you know, I think we're certainly talking months and probably years before that kind of catches up, and you start to see the interest rates go up on everything, and then, you know, the shenanigan will be revealed for what it is.
Oh, sure, yeah, because once those interest rates start going up, all of that expense for the government goes up too. But even more importantly, there's a lot more attention being focused now on the so-called fiscal cliff that we're facing at the end of this year, in part because Ben Bernanke himself is fixated on it, and he keeps saying, look, Congress, you got to deal with this thing because it's beyond what the Fed can reasonably be expected to do. And the thing that he's talking about is that at the end of this year, if Congress doesn't act, there's going to be a $7 trillion tax increase or $7 trillion deeper in debt. Either way you look at it, I mean, and my money, my devalued money is on the latter. My devalued money is on the idea that the government will choose to go $7 trillion deeper in debt before they put $7 trillion worth of taxes on the American people, because it's an easier sell. But nevertheless, you're talking about how it just went up $1 or $2 trillion within the course of a few months. Well, there's a $7 trillion increase facing us probably in about 6 months.
Yeah, my bet is that the government's going to try to take a little bit more, but just try to have it be undetected while at the same time doing the money printing. That's kind of been their modus operandi in the past. And
it has certainly been.
And certainly with the healthcare legislation, taxes are some of them already in place and some of them going into place as we speak, as well as the capital gains taxes going up, as well as the income tax brackets going up. There still is no talk about or a serious bill to keep the what they call the Bush tax breaks in play, which is going to result in, at the end of the day, lots of people paying lots of more money to the government, which will waste it. I mean, I think that this year the interest on the national debt alone, like, you know, the government's collecting or tries to collect somewhere around, I think it's I'm a little bit off on my figures, but I think it's somewhere, they're trying to collect taxes of somewhere around $2 to $3 trillion. It's somewhere in there, so the actual figure, but They're paying about $500 million in interest.
Yeah.
So pretty much what that means for the average taxpayer is, about $1 in $5 that you're paying isn't even being used by any bureaucrat. It's going to whoever holds the Treasury securities. So.
And if we look at what the Bush tax cuts in combination with the alternative minimum tax, which are the two big ones where all this is concerned, if we look at what happens if those end up going into what the current agreement says they'll go into, basically amounting to a tax increase, we're looking at the average household having an average tax increase of $3,000. Even the lowest 20% of households with a tax increase would pay $512 more on average. The top rung would pay around $12,800 more. So it starts to look very real when you start seeing those numbers. Those numbers are serious numbers. And that's only part of the picture. That's the thing. Even when you look at the Bush tax cuts and the AMT, that's only part of the $7 trillion. The overall $7 trillion includes many more than that affects a wide range of taxpayers across the board. So, yeah, we're talking about some really serious tax increases. And at a time when the economy is in recession, that's a really, really, really hard sell. So I don't really see how that's going to come off at all. I really think that they end up going deeper into debt. And I understand what you're saying about how it's likely they're going to try to create money out of thin air. I think they will. But the thing that keeps coming back to me is Ben Bernanke continuously saying, Congress, you got to take care of this. That makes me wonder, is this Bernanke kind of like drawing a line in the sand? Maybe he's saying, I'm getting a little bit scared about all this money we've been creating out of thin air, and maybe we can't, you know, hold the lid on it anymore?
Yeah, it's a good point. And what came out of the last Fed meeting this week is that they held back from further stimulus, saying, "Oh, you know, maybe we will need to do it at a later point." They have continued, as we talked about on the show, they have continued like the Operation Twist to try and suppress the long-term Treasury bond yields, which has been, I would say, moderately successful. So it's, the Fed is just kind of trying to tread water, but you might be onto something. It might, they may very well see the more money as bad. It's hard to tell because they certainly aren't, sharing the truth when they're in public.
That's what's so intriguing about what both the Fed and the European Central Bank have been saying over the last few weeks. They keep talking about how they're ready to jump in there and do what's necessary when stuff happens, but they're not doing anything. And that's out of character. I mean, if you look back at stimuluses over the last, 25 years or so, if the Fed hinted that they were going to do something, they almost always did. And it usually didn't take them very long. Usually they were making a decision within days. Now they're taking weeks or months, and that's out of character. That's out of character. So I'm not sure exactly what that means. I certainly wouldn't put it past either the Fed or the European Central Bank, or actually more likely the two of them working in concert along with the other central banks of the world, to just keep doing everything they can to debase the world's money supplies. But nevertheless, the fact that that is becoming a point of resistance for them, that's really something that catches my attention, that's for sure. Well, we're coming up on break time. Let's take a break, and then after the break, we'll take another look at some of the other fallout that's happening over in Europe, including the comments of the Latvian finance minister about Greece. Plus, we're going to take a look at the latest news on Ron Paul's audit at the Fed, and we're going to look at what's happening over in Syria. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be back after these messages. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And before we go on to the rest of the headlines, just want to remind you, you can always check out the latest and greatest by visiting our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. I have to admit I didn't update it this week. I really need to do that. But there are archives of past shows there on the website. And you can also hear archives of our shows on the parent website, prn.fm, so be sure to check that out. Before we went to the break, we said we'd touch on Europe, but we're also talking about taxes and the possibility of tax increases. Well, it turns out the IRS also has other issues on their minds, and turns out they've been issuing refunds, I can't believe I'm saying this, to identity thieves. Jake, I know you dug into this. What did you find out?
Well, it's an article that came out today on CNN.com, and they're paying out billions of dollars to identity thieves in a report that got released by the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration. So the wording of the article is, quote, the agency failed to prevent 1.5 million potentially fraudulent tax returns from being processed last year, resulting in refunds totaling more than $5.2 billion. That's a B as in billion. They did detect 938,664 identity theft-related tax returns and blocked an additional $6.5 billion from being issued last year. But the Inspector General said that it is, quote, extremely troubling, unquote, that so many others slipped through the cracks. And, you might ask the question, what exactly is a potentially fraudulent return? Well, some examples is that the same address, so someone sent in forms using the same address in Lansing, Michigan, on 2,137 tax returns and received more than $3 million in refunds. And then another five addresses, another person or persons, they don't know because, again, these identity thieves have faded into the night, used five addresses to file nearly 5,000 returns and got a total of $8.1 million. So this is like free money from the government, you know, using the same addresses, you know, hundreds and thousands of times. Tampa was identified as the city with the most tax-related identity theft, with more than $468 million in potentially fraudulent refunds. So one city received nearly $500 million in refunds. And roughly $130 million of that amount was uncovered in wasn't even found out by the IRS. It was found out by the Tampa Police Department. Because they found that the identity thieves not only were filing for these fraudulent tax returns, but they were stealing the identities of the deceased and those who receive public assistance, and you know, just filing multiple tax returns to get back a certain amount. So obviously, the IRS does not have any type of blocking mechanism in place for household. I guess, you know, it's probably reasonable to expect, you know, one household might have several different people filing taxes from it, but certainly not hundreds or thousands. You know, some other problems that they have is there's a lot of these have been filed electronically, and because they allow people to use the same bank account on multiple returns, a lot of these thieves are getting their money electronically deposited into a bank account, and you know, assuredly they're either they will be caught, maybe, or they took the money and ran, which is what a lot of other people would do, since if they're identity thieves, you can be sure that they probably set up a false bank account.
Yeah, that's probably true. Now let me clarify a couple of the points you raised. You said that there's one point some odd billion that was lost to identity thieves, and there was another $6 billion or so that they didn't lose because they were able to stop that. Did I get that right?
Well, the audit found that the IRS has paid out 1.5 million what they call potentially fraudulent tax returns. So 1.5 million returns came in, and they already paid out $5.2 billion to it.
Oh my!
So, you know, we were talking about the budget and, you know, billions and millions, but. $5.2 billion is still a very large amount to be paid back out of the total amount. I think the income tax only brings in somewhere a little bit north of $1 trillion. So 5% of the returns that they're making, they really, you know, they shouldn't be keeping. So, but to answer your other question, they did block $6.5 billion from about a million returns. So,
okay. So they blocked about $6.5 billion. They gave out about $5 billion. So they basically got it right about 55% of the time.
Well, and this is just the ones that they know about. So, you know, basically people tried to steal $11 billion and they made off of $5.2 billion. So I guess
I don't know
if you can figure it out. But, you know, for those that think, you know, one of the fallacies that exist, I think, in society is the idea that the government can't make mistakes, or that somehow the bureaucrats are better than, you know, normal human error. And this type of thing, you know, just, I think, drives home the point that, you know, the people there are bureaucrats. There's really not much drive, and there's no profit motive in government, so why would they, you know, improve the systems that they have other than to make life easier for themselves?
Well, there may not be a profit motive, but there is certainly a, what shall we call it, a scarf-it-up motive.
Yeah.
Basically collect as much money and benefit as you could possibly collect. That motive certainly exists.
Yeah, sure. And,
go ahead.
And again, you know, the whole idea of, you know, paying part of your income to the government, you know, in American terms is kind of new. We haven't had an income tax since 1913, or from before 1913. There was no such thing as an income tax. And following 1913, for many years, it was just the very rich, like kind of like the Mitt Romneys and Barack Obamas, to name two very rich people. Only they would be paying taxes, but you know, over time it developed into something that pretty much if you have a decent job, you are paying taxes.
And the really sad part about the whole thing is the more dishonest you are, the more you make out.
the more honest you are, the more you lose. That seems to be the lesson here, because the identity thieves certainly are among the most dishonest. I would say they rank up there with many politicians, certainly. And they're like, hey, these guys are billionaires now. I mean, $5 billion? That's quite a haul. I don't know how many of them there are, but, man, you divide that up even among, you know, 1,000 people. That's enough to let these guys set themselves up for, you know, in quite a few years very handsomely. So, you know, being a thief apparently does pay very well. On the other hand, if you're an honest person and you try to do the honest thing, but you make mistakes somewhere along the way, then you probably just land yourself 3 years in jail because of an IRS court. That's pretty sad.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, we'll come after you and haul you off to prison eventually. So, you know. And, you know, the other thing they'll do is if you owed money, you know, 5 years ago, they'll charge you, like, interest at 10% each year.
Oh, of course.
Whatever it was, you know, you'll end up owing them triple, quadruple, quintuple the amount. So it's not a very, I wouldn't call it a very fair system.
No.
But, again, it's highly inefficient because if they're, you know, if they don't even have simple things to block in, you know, hundreds and thousands of returns from the same address, you know, what exactly do they have?
Yeah, that part's really rather staggering, isn't it? The fact that they missed that, that's just, oof, how do you miss that? I mean, you got computers, right?
Right, and again, this is just the Treasury inspector going in there. You know, there's certainly, there could easily be a lot more fraud than what was uncovered. I think that should kind of be assumed.
I'm sure there was, and we'll undoubtedly hear more about this in the days and weeks to come. Meanwhile, we did leave a couple of articles kind of hanging in midair that we should talk about from Europe. First, an article that came out in Reuters, this was last week, they reported that the Latvian finance minister, he says that Greece should leave the Eurozone as soon as possible as the country continues to drag down the region. This was Finance Minister Andris Vilks. His comments came after Greek politicians failed last Thursday to agree on a plan to save nearly 12 billion euros over the next 2 years, a setback in its efforts to convince EU and IMF officials it deserves a place in the Eurozone. Quote from Vilks, he says, "It must be understood that one cannot entertain illusions that one can keep Greece in the Eurozone. A way should be found as soon as possible to expel Greece from the Eurozone with as little pain as possible." Yeah, that should be interesting. "My personal solution," he says, "is to do that as soon as possible." Now, you get the feeling he wants to do it as soon as possible, Jake?
Yeah, who was this again saying this?
This was the finance minister of Latvia. Now, granted, Latvia is not going to have a very large role in this, but just the fact that a finance minister of such a tiny country feels so strongly about saying it is interesting all by itself, and suggests to me that even though the financial power resides in Germany and then to a lesser degree in France, hey, the Eurozone is based on the participation of the nations, and if the smaller nations decide to start leaving because they don't like what's happening, you know, for instance, let's say Latvia decides to leave and other smaller countries decide to leave, then the perception of the unity of the Eurozone falls apart just as easily as it happens if you kick Greece out, either way. So it strikes me that this is yet another crack in the dam, so to speak.
Oh, sure. And it's going to be interesting to see how this, you know, this cartel of central banks, you know, kind of evolves over time, because when you have these manipulations, and I think a good example would be, you know, the public fact of, you know, how government central banks manipulated the gold market back in the 1960s, from 1961 to 1968. It's a fact that the United States government and European governments were manipulating the price of gold up and down to profit. But what ended up happening was, since the U.S. was doing all this wartime spending and, you know, the societal spending with, you know, Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society and the Vietnam War, that France started getting nervous and started taking their gold out of the pool and left the pool in 1967, and it collapsed. And, you know, resulted in a monetary crisis and eventually the complete decoupling of the dollar from gold, and hence, you know, this era of purely paper money. But, you know, it's going to be, the thing is, like, some of these central banks are not necessarily, they don't, just like France did in the 1960s, there's going to be a point where they'll be like, okay, we need to protect ourselves and our people from this fallout, because, you know, either it's that or all go down over the waterfall together. But eventually there'll be some places, probably not the United States, but some places that will say, hey, we want out. And I think one example of that is what just came out today, that the South Korean central bank bought an additional 16 tons of gold in July, which is nothing new. A lot of these central banks are now net buyers of gold and trying to take it off the market. And, you know, so something like that, which is, you know, a purchase of roughly, I think $810 million was spent, and they got 70 point, they boosted their gold holdings to 70.4 tons. They went from 54 to 70, so it's a pretty sizable increase in their
for their economy as small as South Korea. That's a pretty sizable increase, to be sure.
Sure, and you know, back during the Asian financial crisis back in 1997, 1998, this is the same country with the same central bank that held lotteries of people to donate their gold to the country to save the country from the Asian financial crisis, which many South Korean citizens patriotically did, and the gold just got swallowed up by the market without barely a blip in the devaluation of, I think the South Korean currency is the won. It continued to devalue, didn't do anything. And I think in this case, you might have these the central bank of this country learning from its past mistakes and saying, hey, you know, gold's here at, you know, $1,580 an ounce. You know, last year it was at $1,900 an ounce. Do you see anybody stopping printing money? No. Let's protect our, their foreign exchange reserves, because South Korea is one of the countries that is as a net exporter, and has so built up these massive paper currency reserves, which, if the paper currencies were to be massively devalued, it would certainly it would probably actually make their bank insolvent. So in this case, for such a small country, this is done as, you know, purely an insurance move. And I think that the comments in the article from the central bankers pretty much also indicates that this is an insurance move for their currency.
Yeah, absolutely true. And in fact, you mentioned the manipulation of the currencies around the world. Probably the central manipulator these days is the Federal Reserve, because the dollar is a world reserve currency. One of the reasons, of course, why Congressman Ron Paul for so long has been pushing his Audit the Fed bill, as well as his Free Competition and Currency bill and other bills that he's put forth to try to get us off of this crazy monetary treadmill that we're on.
We would actually audit the Federal Reserve? Yeah. Is that what you're saying? We'd actually audit a government agency?
Yeah, well, the Fed actually isn't a government agency. It's a private
quasi.
Agency.
Quasi.
Government power, but yes, well. But yeah, actually, that's what he had in mind, audit the Fed. And he did get it passed the House. Of course, the question now is getting it passed the Senate. And toward that end, he posted something on his House website. Of course, all congressmen or Congress critters, as some like to call them, have their own websites. And on his website, he posted a message about this very topic. I just wanted to read to you some of that message. He says, last week, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed my legislation calling for a full and effective audit of the Federal Reserve. Well over 300 of my congressional colleagues supported the bill, each casting a landmark vote that marks the culmination of decades of work. We have taken a big step toward bringing transparency to the most destructive financial institution in the world. But in many ways, our work is only beginning. Despite the Senate Majority Leader's past support for similar legislation, no vote has been scheduled on my bill this year in the Senate, and only 29 senators have co-sponsored Senator Rand Paul's version of my bill in the other body. If your senator is not listed at the link above, please contact them and ask for their support. Interesting tactic here, basically going to the people, trying to get the people to get their senators to support Paul's bill. But anyway, he goes on and says, understand that last week's historic vote never would have taken place without the efforts of millions of Americans like you, ordinary citizens concerned about liberty and the integrity of our currency. Political elites respond to political pressure, pure and simple. They follow rather than lead. If all 100 senators feel enough grassroots pressure, they will respond and force Senate leadership to hold what will be a very popular vote. In fact, audit the Fed is so popular that 75% of all Americans support it, according to a Rasmussen poll. We are making progress. So here's the thing. He's using his government website in order to get the people to lobby the Senate. That's really quite unusual. I can't remember the last time I saw something like that. Can you?
Yeah, you know, it's I guess that would be kind of unusual to have, you know, a congressman try to lobby the Senate using his government page, but, you know, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against it. I think it's actually rather refreshing, but it just struck me as that's kind of different. You don't normally see that. And, of course, the way Congressman Paul works with his massive grassroots support, it makes a lot of sense that he would do that, but nevertheless, I thought that was worth noting today. Well, a couple more stories that we want to get in before our hour is up. First of all, I wanted to take a moment to mention the news that came out today about Syria. It turns out that the United Nations top diplomat in Syria decided that he couldn't put up with it anymore. I'm going to read today from the New York Times article, although you can find lots of articles online about it. The article was written by Richard Gladstone and entitled Anan casts blame widely as he resigns as Syria envoy. It says, frustrated by the seemingly intractable Syrian conflict, Kofi Annan announced his resignation on Thursday as the special peace envoy of the United Nations and the Arab League, throwing new doubts on whether a diplomatic solution is possible. He also said President Bashar al-Assad of Syria must leave office. In an announcement tinged with bitterness and regret, Mr. Annan said he could no longer do the job, blaming his decision on what he described as Syrian government intransigence, increasing militants by Syrian rebels, and the failure of a divided Security Council to rally forcefully behind his efforts. He said, quote, I accepted this task, which some called mission impossible, for I believed it was a sacred duty to do whatever was in my power to help the Syrian people find a peaceful solution to this bloody conflict. But he said, without serious, purposeful, and united international pressure, including for the powers of the region, it is impossible for me or anyone to compel the Syrian government in the first place, and also the opposition, to take the steps necessary to begin a political process. He also said, at a time when we need, when the Syrian people desperately need action, there continues to be finger-pointing and name-calling in the Security Council. Now, we should point out, Mr. Annan is a past Nobel Peace Prize winner, and he was unanimously given the post in the hope that he could negotiate some sort of settlement there. He actually did negotiate a settlement, but the Syrian government did absolutely nothing to invoke it and put it into practice, and so basically he was held up as the straw man that he actually is. But nevertheless, very interesting development as the top UN envoy to Syria has basically left the scene. And this adds to the power vacuum going on over in Syria.
Oh, sure.
And then finally, one other thing that we haven't touched on in quite some time, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, he's still holed up in that embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK, still requesting political asylum. And that's a story that has kind of fallen by the wayside. But there was an article in The Nation this week that appeared under the byline of Kevin Gostola, I believe his name is, called The Fate of Julian Assange. And just wanted to read to you a couple of, a few paragraphs of this, because it's got some interesting stuff in it. He says that the Ecuadorian government appears to be seriously considering the possibility of granting Assange asylum. President Rafael Correa has said the situation is not simple unless he's studied thoroughly before the country can announce a decision. And then Ecuadorian Foreign Minister Ricardo Patiño has indicated Ecuador will release a document that may be hundreds of pages long, which will provide sufficient justification for the decision made because the country realizes it could have great international impact. Now, statements made by both Correa and Patiño seem to favor Assange, although they have not actually made any official statement to that effect. Patino told the press on July 5th he found the sexual assault allegations against Assange to be, quote, hilarious, unquote, because he says they stem from a broken condom. Have we heard that one before, a broken condom? I don't remember that particular piece of information coming out.
No.
Also, on June 22nd, Correa said, in Ecuador, if someone had done 100th of what has been done to Assange, they would be called dictators and oppressors. Correa also later declared Ecuador, quote, will consult with everyone, unquote, but the country will make a sovereign decision and not be pressured by Sweden, the UK, or the United States. So it looks like that Ecuador is trying to work out a way to come out in favor of protecting Assange. Of course, the big question from a practical perspective is, can they actually get him out of the UK? And there's a tremendous amount of doubt whether that will be even possible, specifically because the UK government had made it clear that the moment that he steps outside the Ecuadorian embassy, he's going to be arrested regardless of what the Ecuadorians do. But nevertheless, the wheels of progress move exceedingly slowly. As far as Julian Assange is concerned. By the way, the article made another very interesting point. Let me read this particular paragraph to you. It says that the first sign of what is actually going on is that Swedish authorities have not questioned him yet. As Susan Ben of the Julian Assange Defense Fund stated on June 29th, although it is normal procedure, Swedish authorities have refused, without giving any reason, to make the three-hour trip to London and to interview Julian, causing him to be trapped in the UK under virtual house arrest for over 500 days. And I'm not quite sure I'd agree with the way she phrased that, but it is an interesting point. I mean, it's very common for officials and authorities from one country to go into another country where there's warned out for someone's arrest and deportation to interview him while that person is in custody. And yet the Swedish authorities have refused to do that. That's really quite surprising. I mean, I can't think of any reason why that would happen. And yet that appears to be happening. So I guess it kind of raises the question, is it perhaps true that Assange is right, that maybe this is like one great big conspiracy orchestrated by the United States government to basically get him back in U.S. territory so they can charge him with espionage and treason?
Yeah, who knows? And that's what he's saying and giving as a main, reason. And I think if he does fear, you know, to be extradited to the U.S., he's also claiming that they'll torture him, which under our Patriot Act, it's sad to say, but it would be, I don't want to say it would be legal, but it would be technically illegal. It would be morally wrong, but that's what the Patriot Act is there for, to allow the government to torture people that it doesn't like without having to go through any type of court or publicity. So I think that, he's been holed up in, like you said, he's been held up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 6 weeks, sort of like right where the Olympics is going on. And the thing that kind of gets me is that Ecuador has tried to get Sweden to come in and just talk to him and question him about the crimes that they claim that he's committed. And Sweden has not taken that offer. They've turned it down, which obviously makes the situation a whole lot more complicated. If he steps outside that embassy, he could be, scooped up by whoever.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a sad world that we live in when you actually have to fear that. And, in a place that has like a rule of law, you'd easily have some decorum would be followed, such as questioning the person and letting them know what they're being charged with. But in his particular situation where they're trying to get him out from a different country, it's a real shame. And, it's certainly kind of put a crimp in the whole WikiLeaks. I think they have been somewhat active, but certainly aren't as much of a headache for the government as they were when the data was coming out.
Well, they may not be as much of a headache, but the government appears to be paying a tremendous amount of attention to them, because the same Nation article reports that in a June motion in a hearing in the case of Private First Class Bradley Manning, that's the soldier accused of releasing classified information to WikiLeaks, it was revealed that the FBI has a 42,135-page investigative file into WikiLeaks. Only 8,741 of the pages are allegedly relevant to Manning's case. That means that more than 30,000 of the other pages likely involve evidence the U.S. government has on Assange and WikiLeaks staffers or volunteers. And as the author of the article points out, it's hard to imagine that this investigative file would be put together if the U.S. government did not plan to prosecute someone. Not to mention Manning is charged with aiding the enemy, and military prosecutors have established in court that the enemy is Al-Qaeda. So basically, it looks like that the U.S. is trying to connect the dots and say that WikiLeaks is essentially associated with Al-Qaeda. That's quite a thing. Well, we're reaching the end of the news hour here, and Jake, as usual, it's been a pleasure, but thanks for joining us today.
Hey, glad I could make it, sir. Is it that late?
Oh, well, you made it. That's the important thing. And we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Hey,